Welcome to Bobby Osinski's Inner Circle. I'm Bobby Osinski, and this is a show all about music, music production, and the music business. My guest today is mixing engineer Bob Brockman. But first, let's talk a little bit about teens leaving Facebook. It's interesting because every couple months, there's a new study that basically contradicts the one before. So if you go back about a year, teens were leaving Facebook in droves. And then a couple months after that, they weren't leaving at all. And a couple months after that, yes, they were leaving. And then a couple months after that, of course, everything changed again. And now we're actually back to teens are leaving Facebook. Why is this important? Well, if you're an artist or a band, you want to know where your audience is. If your audience is younger people, a younger demographic, if your audience is basically teens, then you want to know how to get to them, which means you need to know what their social networks of choice might be. So as a result, this kind of information is really important. So now it looks like teens are leaving Facebook for other social networks. But I think I trust the study a little bit more because the information actually comes from Facebook itself. So when you look at that, you think, well, wait a second, if they're giving out this information, then there must be something more to it, and perhaps there's something more serious about this. But the thing you have to ask yourself is, where are they going to? If they're not on Facebook, where are they going to? It turns out that they're going to Instagram, first of all. As far as Facebook is concerned, this is a good thing because Facebook owns Instagram. So that's not a bad thing, and that's one of the reasons why Facebook wanted to buy Instagram in the first place, because they wanted to make sure that they maintained their relationship with this demographic. So it looks like that has worked out fairly well. Where else are they going? Well, Snapchat is another one, and Snapchat has gone up and down in terms of popularity, but in terms of teens, it's always been fairly popular, and it continues to stay that way. And you see teens using Snapchat more than they're using Facebook these days. Teens are also using messaging apps like WhatsApp and Kik. Teens like to message one another. And of course, they can do it in any number of ways. Texting, of course, is still a big one, but they do like to use a social network to do this, and this is another way to do it. A big up-and-comer is a network called Feed, P-H-E-E-D. Feed.com. And this is basically a multimedia toolkit. So what it does, it allows the users to just have more control over all sorts of things that is more graphically or video or audio oriented. So Feed is an up-and-comer. Ask FM is another one that's big with teens. And of course, Twitter still has a lot of clout with teens. All that being said, the teen demographic is very, very fickle. It can change really quickly. And of course, this has happened over and over. So what you're hearing today may not be the same tomorrow. So come back tomorrow and let's see how much it's changed, if at all. But for now, teens look to be leaving Facebook for other social networks. Next thing I want to talk about is what to do when the song is over. For all you artists, all you players out there, all you people that are on stage all the time, this is something that many of us take for granted. But the one thing about the old performers of vaudeville is they knew how to work a crowd, and there are some tried and true aspects of doing this. That there's only a few people teach this, and one is Tom Jackson. And Tom Jackson specializes in coaching bands and artists just in stage performance. He wrote an article that I put a little bit of it on my Big Picture production blog. And it's all about what should you do when the song is over. And you should do more than you think. And there are many things that you shouldn't do. So let's go over them. Tom Jackson's premise is that you're asking the audience for applause at the end of a song, but you want to do it non-verbally. One of the ways is to hold your ground on stage and don't back up. And many artists, you'll find, well, as soon as a song is over, they'll back up. Or what they'll do is they'll turn around and turn their back to the audience, which is another no-no. They expect people not to really, not only applaud, but to ignore you when you ignore them. Tom also suggests that you pick a couple of people out of the audience and smile at them or nod at them or pump your fist at them. Generally, just connect with them, and that's always a good thing. Once again, it's hard when you do it to an entire crowd. It's kind of easier when you single someone out and do it just to them. Singers should put the mic down to their side if they're holding it. There's another suggestion that he has. Or if you're standing behind a mic, step to the side so the audience doesn't think that you're about to talk. Some of the things that you shouldn't do. First thing is don't back up. Don't turn your back on an audience. Don't adjust your gear. This is something that guitar players do all the time. Song is over. All of a sudden, they're changing a pedal, changing an amplifier, doing something instead of acknowledging the audience or asking them nonverbally to connect. Another thing is you shouldn't talk to another band member. And a lot of times, bands, especially young bands, do this all the time, and it's something that they don't even think about. Another thing is you shouldn't say thank you into the mic immediately after the song ends. You should give the audience some time to applaud, because if you thank them too early, you can cut the applause off. You can cut their response off. So these are just a few things to think about next time you're on stage. Some things to think about when the song is over that you should do, and some things that you shouldn't do as well. Any questions or comments, please send them to questions@bobbyoinnercircle.com. questions@bobbyoinnercircle.com. My guest today is Bob Brockman, and Bassy Bob is his nickname, and Bassy Bob has been mixing hits for all sorts of artists. You've heard his stuff on the radio forever. He's done records for everyone from P. Diddy to Faith Hill to Korn to Christina Aguilera, Sheryl Crow, the Dixie Chicks even, just a wide variety of music celebs, great artists, and different genres. He's been nominated for 30 Grammys, and he's won two. That's not easy, believe me. He's a great interview as well and a great guy. So I spoke with Bob from his studio via Skype. Here today with Bob Brockman, Bassy Bob. Thanks so much for being on my podcast, Bob.
Oh, my pleasure, Bobby. It's great talking to you in person. I love your book.
Well, thank you very much. And thanks for being in it, by the way.
Oh, my pleasure.
Yeah. So how did you get your name? How did you get Bassy Bob?
Well, I mean, Bassy Bob is a name that was given to me by a dance producer named Randy Muller, who had a lot of big hits in the 70s and the 80s with Sky and Brass Construction. And I was one of my first jobs in New York was an intern at a studio called Secret Sound in New York City. And, you know, I was basically just I was a gopher at that point. I was just running errands, mostly going and getting food deliveries for the clients. And in the meantime, I would practice my bass in my headphones out in the lobby of the studio because it was boring. It wasn't a lot to do. And Randy was working on a track for Polygram. I don't know whether I don't think it was a Brass Construction track. It was for some solo artist he was doing. But it was one of those records where he needed to deliver the mix at the end of the day. And I guess the card had gone out on the tape machine on his bass track. And so he came out into the lobby just fuming, and he was so angry and frustrated that, you know, he needed to deliver this record. And for some reason, I raised my hand and I said, you know, Mr. Muller, I've been listening to this bass line for hours through the door. I could fix your part. And he was a quite imposing person. He's about 6'6" with a flat top and, you know, one of those big wide lapel jackets. And so I was quite intimidated. But at the same time, I think he was taken aback by, you know, my gumption for actually saying that I could play bass on his track. But he gave me a shot, and so I went in and I think in about two passes managed to sort of replicate the bass part that was on his record. So about 2 weeks later, he called to book another session at the studio, and I guess he took a shine to me and said to the secretary, "Where's Bassy Bob at?" And the secretary thought that was really hilarious. And so she and a couple other people in the studio started calling me Bassy Bob, which was, it wasn't the most favorable nickname. But about 6 months later, I had done a rough mix of a Debbie Gibson song called Only in My Dreams for Fred Czarr, who was another producer that I was working with on the weekends. When the single, got picked up after the 12-inch that Little Louis Vega did was so successful, Fred asked me what my credit should read on the 7-inch. And so I told him basically Bob, because I just needed to give him an answer right on the spot. And it kind of stuck.
It's always good to have a nickname. People remember it.
Well, I mean, it's very commonplace for mixers to have nicknames.
Yeah.
I don't know. I don't know whether that tradition is still is still continuing in the mix world. But I mean, it certainly is alive and well in the hip hop community, with producers and rappers having their own nicknames.
Well, speaking of which, so you mix a lot of different genres.
I do. Yeah.
I mean, you go from country. I see Faith Hill here, Diddy, Sting, Santana, and on and on. It's, you know, it seems like every mix you do is in a different genre. Do you approach them all the same, or do you come from a different mixing mindset for each one?
No, I think it is a different mindset, Bobby. I mean, you might even go so microcosmically to say that every song is a different mindset, because it requires a unique solution. And that's really the way I approach it, as a sort of a solution provider. You know, not that every song is a problem. Some songs are more problematic than others, just because productions aren't always as facile as you would like them to be. Some of them are really torturous and some of them are really easy. Mm-hmm. But certainly, the rules not only change from song to song and genre to genre, but also from era to era. And I feel like, you know, now I'm kind of at the point in my mixing career where, you know, I've mixed through a number of different eras, you know, in which the style of mixing that's currently popular changes.
Yeah.
At radio, it goes from very, very wet. I mean, you know, there was a sort of, you know, the power rock ballads of the 80s, you know, which were supplanted by, you know, Nirvana and indie rock, which was quite dry, as well as hip hop in the 90s, which, I mean, I remember it was just anathema to put reverb on anything. Although I did manage to sneak reverb on certain, you know, Biggie mixes and other records, because I think at that time, you know, Puffy was really trying to sort of bring another sound, which is not necessarily a new sound, but a sound that had existed in the 80s in hip hop, where there was a lot of reverb on the drums, you know, sampling Melly Mel, you know, sampling a lot of these kind of big sounding early hip hop records, and giving them a new life and breathing a new life into them with the artists that he was collaborating with, was a way in which, you know, he was sort of going against the grain of where hip hop had been for 5 or 6 years, which was really like really dusty, dry drum loops and really, really dry vocals.
Yeah.
And, you know, and then, you know, that sort of gave way to, you know, I guess what you might call millennial, you know, hip hop and indie music, which is extremely reverberant, you know, I mean, to the point where it's as cavernous as the Beach Boys, you know, were in their era now, you know, with all of these, you know, with all these indie rock bands like Fun and Passion Pit and, you know, Edward Sharp, they've gone through the same transition from sort of the grungy, dry indie rock of Nirvana and Pearl Jam to, you know, artists like The Weeknd, you know, or Frank Ocean, you know, artists yeah. who are making really sonically aggressive kinds of records, you know, in terms of like reverb and delays and effects, that sort of thing.
When you talk about dry, you're talking about just dry, lack of reverb, or, you know, dry with short delays?
No, I mean dry, you know, okay. Like Tribe Called Quest dry, you know, where, yeah. it, the only reverb that you might hear is, you know, the fifth generation room sound from the clip that's been pulled off the record, you know, that's the basis of the track. And I mean, there's something, there's something incredibly elegant about that. And it's not the easiest thing to mix a dry record, actually.
I was just going to ask you, yeah, is that harder or?
It is hard. Yeah. It is hard. It's challenging because, you know, there are ways in which you can use reverb and delays to sync things in and to get things to kind of nestle in a really, really nice way and almost get to that sort of three-dimensional space more easily than because sound is very, very sensitive when it's dry. Vocals and snare and bass are very, very sensitive when they're dry. When you move them a tiny fraction, you hear it. Whereas you can move things around when there's a lot of reverb on them and you can kind of get away with it and it's not as obvious.
Yeah, there's a glue there. I have a really hard time. The drier it is, it gets much more difficult for me.
It is. It's a struggle. And I mean, I would say that those same rules apply to other kinds of dry music like jazz, you know. I mean, you can mix a jazz record with a lot of reverb, like a Mark Isham record, you know, or a Dave Douglas record, or you can mix it really, really dry, like all of those, you know, CTI, you know, records from the 70s, where there was just like those Bob James records and Herbie records and, you know, Grover Washington records. I mean, there was nothing on it. Yeah. It's completely spare. And it just seems to, you know, sort of like vacillate, you know, back and forth, sort of the way hemlines go up and down, you know, from decade to decade. And, you know, I mean, I'm fortunate enough to sort of, I guess you could say, still be in the game to some extent, you know, as a mixer, although there are a lot of other things that I do with my time now. You know, it's certainly my career has evolved with the radical changes that the industry has gone through in the last decade.
Well, speaking of which, I see that you're doing mix consulting now.
I am. I mean, I think that, I mean, not just mix consulting, but also just education in general. You know, I'm doing seminars. I'm creating media now with the Elements of Mixing, which, you know, I think hopefully should maybe move the needle a little bit further forward in terms of trying to take something which is incredibly intuitive and complex and teach it, which is why I think it's so hard at the university level to teach mixing. I mean, you can teach the history of recording, you can teach microphones, you can teach acoustics, because those are all like fairly dry subjects. But mixing is not dry. It's like composition or production. You know, it's incredibly creative and nuanced. And I don't necessarily think that you have to be a natural to be a good mixer. I think that you can actually teach people to mix. And I think that more and more what's happening in the industry is that you're seeing the emergence of millennial producers and writers who are really doing everything, particularly in the Asian world. You know, you're seeing, you know, production teams that do everything from, you know, A&R to developing the songs to, you know, producing the vocals, recording, you know, and mixing their own stuff, and in many cases mastering their own stuff. So, I mean, if that is the trend of where the industry is going, then I would like to be able to, you know, to facilitate that journey of a person, you know, learning how to mix, because I don't think that producers can necessarily always depend that they're always going to have a budget or the means or the wherewithal, whether it's independently or with a major label, even to hire a recordist and to hire a mixer to do their project.
See, for me, I always thought that one of the big things that was great about the former system we had with the mentorship, where you started as an assistant, and you were kind of mentored by engineers and producers that you heard that you work with. One of the advantages was you got to hear some really good stuff. So you had a reference point. And one of the problems in the schools is you're never sure whether you're going to, most of the time, you don't get that. So that's
very true. I mean, like most of the time, you're just stuck on, you know, an inbox, you know, with your own project, just trying to sort of like feel your way and find your way, you know, through the creative process. And I mean, obviously, I mean, people can self-teach themselves to do almost anything, but, I mean, I had the benefit of, you know, of sort of, you know, tutoring under guys like Chris Lord-Alge and Andy Wallace and Bob Rosa, you know, like many other great mixers at Soundtrack and Unique. You know, when I went through my fairly brief tenure as an assistant, because I ended up mixing accidentally a hit record while I was at Soundtrack, and Rob Covecchio the next week put me on the street and said, "Well, good luck, kid. You're a freelancer now." And I was like, "Oh, what does that mean?" I was 22, you know. I didn't even really know what Billboard magazine was, you know. I mean, I was like incredibly green, and yet I had sort of accidentally happened into a couple records that were successful. And
you know, what does that mean, accidentally?
Well, I mean, because you know, the Debbie Gibson record that I mixed, "Only in My Dreams," was a demo that Fred had asked me to do on a Saturday afternoon, and it was really only because of the circumstance of the 12-inch that Little Louis Vega had did, which went to number one on the 12-inch charts, that Atlantic needed a single, and so they had a DAT from the, you know, the presentation mix that Fred had given to Atlantic for her single deal, to basically present them with an idea for a single for Debbie. And I certainly, you know, I wasn't privy to that whole thing that was happening. I only found out about it when Fred called me. And then the same thing happened with Gwen Guthrie, "Ain't Nothing Going On But the Rent," which was another record that I mixed at Soundtrack when I was an assistant. And that started my relationship with Pick Conley from Surface, you know, which lasted for over a decade. Yeah. You know, I mean, everybody from, you know, Rebe Jackson to Jermaine Jackson to Aretha to, you know, a lot of Arista artists that were, you know, sort of in Pick's wheelhouse as a producer. I mean, that is what happens, you know, in your career. You know, you meet certain people, sometimes accidentally, that end up being long-term clients. And I mean, the same thing happened with Puffy. You know, I mean, I think almost 8.5 years I spent, you know, working with him, that really just grew out of like one overdub session, you know, that we did together.
Yeah.
I think it's, you know, it's, it is really a people business. It's very, very much a people business. It's very much a relationship business. And I think that,
here today with Bob,
you know, tending those relationships is as important, maybe even more important than how skilled you are in your craft.
Yeah. I, you know, the other thing is you have to be fun to work with. If not fun, at least you can't cause any hassles. And the more,
absolutely. You know, and just like keeping the good vibes going,
yep.
You know, because inevitably, I mean, we all know this from watching VH1 documentaries and also from our own experiences working with artists, you know, that whether it's an artist and the artist manager or whether it's, you know, band members, you know, when you're working, say with a group like Screedy Politi, where, you know, the two protagonists can't stand each other and can't be in the same room with each other for more than 3 minutes without getting angry. You know, you kind of have to be sort of lighthearted about that. And that requires a particular kind of, I don't know whether selflessness is the word, but I think it's about sort of removing your agenda from the room so that artists can basically have their space.
Yeah.
To do their thing. And also just, I think just generally speaking, it doesn't matter what the art or the craft is, whether it's filmmaking or television or music. I think that the better the vibe is and the more positive that you can keep the energy, you know, either by, you know, having a sense of humor and being able to pull people out of their rut, by, you know, maybe just reminding them that it's, as Quincy Jones said, it's not brain surgery. Nobody's going to die on the table. But even doctors that operate on brains have to have a sense of humor, otherwise they go crazy,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, right.
So, yeah, I mean, that's one thing that I definitely learned from, you know, maybe my short time, you know, year and a half assisting, just, you know, watching other engineers do their thing. And then, of course, over the course of my career, watching producers do their thing, which is really the same job. It's just another level up the chain.
Yeah, right.
Because, you know, you're serving the A&R guy, you're serving the president, you're serving the label, you're definitely serving the artist. and you know, and I really look at it more and more, you know, as I progress, you know, is it's about service when it really, really comes down to it. It's yeah. just about it's just about serving the creative goals of the people that you're working with, and the better you serve it, and the more that you can kind of like get out of the finish line with everybody feeling good, the more successful you can be, I think.
Did your signal path change, your mixing signal path, since the last time we talked? Is there anything different? I mean, we talked about a year and a half ago, I think, for the interview for the Mixing Engineer's Handbook. And I know that you were both hardware and plugins centric. Did anything change?
Well, I mean, yeah. I mean, I have pulled away from, I guess, my sort of empathetic attachment to hardware versions of inserts, mostly because I found that I was not fully serving my clients, because I wasn't always able to replicate the sound that I had created by doing a science experiment with like tubes and transformers. And I've really shifted to, I would say, with the exception of my Neve summing mixer, which I still don't think that I'm still using it because I'm emotionally attached to the Neve. I think I'm still using it because it still does a better job of creating three-dimensional space and summing than doing it within, say the platform, you know, of 12, you know, auxes or submasters within a DAW, you know, whether it be Pro Tools or Logic. I still think it sounds better to my ears, and I can see the image more clearly when I break them out into separate outputs on a summing mixer. But I'm not really doing much in the way of actual analog processing anymore, except on the production and the recording side, which I use shitloads of analog processing, because I think, you know, that's a great way to kind of create the sound of the record and sort of burn it into the recording.
Yeah, right.
But on the mix side, I think, you know, like one of the things that sort of was a game changer for me was transitioning into using the Apollo and all the UAD stuff,
yeah.
because there are so many emulations. And I mean, there's certainly, UAD is certainly not, it's not the only plugin company that I really rely on. I mean, I really love the Soundtoy stuff, the FabFilter stuff, the Stephen Massey stuff. I mean, there's a lot of really good stuff being done by companies like Brainworks. You know, the Chandler stuff. There's a lot of stuff that really sounds good. Like the new Thermiotic Culture, for example, by UAD, it doesn't sound exactly the same as the hardware box, you know, nor does the 1073 sound exactly the same as the 1073, but it does do a lot of the same things.
Right.
You know, when you crank up the line gain, when you crank up the fader, when you open up the EQ, it really does something.
Yeah.
It really does something sonically. And I think that that's fairly new, and that's probably, I would guess, have to do with just the creative evolution of how people are sampling and, you know, and creating these kind of clones of hardware pieces. Ultimately, it ends up being the same thing in the long run, which is that it's about, you know, it's about space, you know, it's about reverberant space, it's about saturation, and it's about compression. That's what makes records sound big.
Yeah.
In my estimation.
Well,
I'm using the same principles, you know. I'm, you know, whether it's putting shitloads of reverb on the vocal or shitloads of reverb on the drums and then smashing it the same way Phil Spector would have with George Harrison in 1967. You know, it's just that he had two reverbs and he had one compressor, the Fairchild, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
And now there's a lot of compressors out there, you know. And I also think that, you know, this whole kind of like, you know, DIY, you know, EDM movement that's happening with all these guys mixing records, you know, in the box, you know, mostly with Logic and Ableton, are coming up with really like extraordinary things. And, you know, I was a little sonically averse to all of this digital distortion, about 5 years ago, but I'm starting to kind of warm to it, you know.
Yeah.
Maybe the way, an uptight, set of parents would warm to the sound of an electric guitar, in the 60s. It's just because, all of this kind of like glitchy, edgy kind of distortion that, a lot of the young producers in at least in the dance world are using it. And to some extent in the pop world too. I think that you're hearing a lot more of that kind of like edgy digital distortion and multiband compression and digital compression.
Yeah.
Like brick wall limiting on lots of things, on the whole mix, on the lead vocal. I mean, records are just, are getting louder and louder because people are not afraid to push beyond the distortion envelope.
I have a really good friend who's a mastering engineer, and I don't think I should mention his name because he tells me that he gets a lot of things in that have overs. And he's gotten to the point where he leaves them in because he says, no one worries about it. They like the sound. And if I actually fix it, then they yell at me. So it's gotten to that point.
I just went through that with a project that I just did for a major, which, I won't mention the artist or the label, but, I went through 19 revisions over a 3-week period, a lot of which involved... I think one of the most difficult things I've encountered is the effect that Pro Tools has had on the role of the mixer. Because Pro Tools is not just a recording platform, it's a mixing platform. There's always a mix there. And more than often, the mix is done by the producer or the producer's assistant, not usually done by a mixer. And, in many cases has many of the things that you just mentioned, has a lot of artifacts, is really crunchy, is really blown out, is really spread out. And this was a case of me trying to fix that. And, I think that was that was sort of a tactical mistake on my part, Each revision, I was trying more and more, to use my transformers and to use the gain staging of the Neve to match what they were doing, but do a better version of it. But what I was doing was a cleaner version of it.
Yeah, yeah.
And ultimately that's not what everybody wanted. Including label presidents have become, enamored of this kind of, really loud, really blown out, really, crunchy approach to mixing. And I mean, the other thing is that it's the job has changed,
Yeah.
Not so much on records that I'm producing, but on records in which I'm hired to mix, I find myself chasing the demo all the time now.
Yeah.
And that's not a very creative endeavor. It makes me feel sort of reminiscent about, the days when I would be delivered a multitrack and, they would maybe have a cassette that they were living with that they liked certain things about, but it wasn't like you were matching the cassette.
It was easier to beat the demo too, way back when.
It was easier to beat the demo because the demo usually sounded shitty and was not really considered acceptable by anybody. Certain aspects of the mix, maybe certain perspective things. I mean, I know that a lot of times, you would have a really loud vocal in a demo, and so you would try to like maintain that kind of primacy with the lead vocal while at the same time wrapping more information around it.
Yeah.
But it was still like somewhat of a creative enterprise. And I mean, mixing is an extraordinarily creative thing. And I think you just find, more and more people just doing everything by themselves because, they're not necessarily dependent any longer on a mixer to create a mix. And of course, a lot of people create mixes that are horrible and they think that they're fine because they created them.
Yeah, right.
And that's where you get into the realm of, sort of the disappearance of expertise in all media.
Yeah, no, definitely. And the common denominator of the fact that everything is cheaper, easier to get, everybody has access to, that's the good part. The bad part is everybody thinks they can do it on a quality level. And as a result, I think the bar has lowered of what's acceptable.
The bar is lowered, and it creates a lot of confusion in the marketplace. You know, I mean, I often liken the current music climate to, you know, the bodega in your neighborhood, where everything is stacked to the ceiling and you can't really see anything or get to anything. So you just end up leaving the shop buying nothing. I think that that's what a lot of consumers are doing, because they're just being inundated with content. Yeah. And, you know, honestly, not all that content is great. I mean, not all of that content has ever been great. It's just that, you know, the stuff, you know, the cassettes that were left in the dustbin of the mailroom at the record company, which was really the only pathway for listeners to hear people's music, you know, outside of local touring groups, is gone. And now, if you're on somebody's SoundCloud or YouTube mailing list, you know, you're being pillared with stuff which is, you know, in many cases, you know, not fully thought out and substandard. And there's really no bar there. There's no filtering. There's no limitation to people posting as much of their musings as they want. And I'm certainly not against co-creation. I mean, I think it's a great innovation. And I think the fact that people are able to share music so easily with one another is a wonderful thing. At the same time, you know, I think that there is always a bar.
Yeah.
In any kind of media. And I think that you see more of it in music than other media. Maybe journalism, you know, with DIY journalism.
So you mentioned before about how you're more in the box than you were before. Does that include your Alan Smart across the mix bus?
Not using the Alan Smart anymore.
What are you using in its place?
I'm doing it all really through the UAD mixer. I'm processing the mix using... Well, there are two things I use. I use the Oxford Inflator, and I use the Master Bus Limiter.
The Precision Limiter?
The Precision, that's what it's called, the Precision Limiter from UAD, And, you know, it's really clean, and it's really effective, and it's fully recallable. I mean, I had too many problems over the last couple of years. I mean, people have really just grown dependent on the idea of hearing exactly the same mix. I mean, you know, back in the day, you'd have like a team of four guys like dialing every knob on the SSL, and you know, you'd be moving the knob around on your Summit limiter or your 33609 or whatever, and there were just so many moving parts in a recall that you got it really close, and you would go back and forth and A/B it to the two track, and you got to a point where it felt good, you know.
Yeah.
It's like, yeah, that's close. And then the producer would be able to make whatever, you know, adjustments they wanted for the next revision. And most of that was burned into the automation of the console, whether it was a Neve or an SSL. You know, now everything is automated and everything is stored.
But one of the things you mentioned in the interview we did for the book was how automation and everything being automated has changed mixing and made everything a lot slicker. And you know what? That kind of burned into my mind. And you were absolutely right. It's like, you know, there are things that we never could do before that now we can do. If you want to EQ, you know, a phrase or forget about a phrase, if, you know, part of a word, you can, you know, just for that split second. And you never could do that before. But that means that mixes are more complex as a result.
They're more complex and they take longer, and the demands on mixing are greater than ever. I mean, you know, with all of the DIY stuff that's out there, you know, the competition for the top 7 or 10 slots, you know, on platinum radio is intense. And, you know, I think it's a harder job now than it was, because there are endless choices, and there are endless opportunities to crank it up one more notch in the chorus, or one more notch in, you know, the ramp section of a song, or to be more, even more detailed in terms of how you blend the backgrounds, you know, to the point where
you know, producers will ask you to, well, can you just brighten the third note in the chord a little bit more in the second half of the chorus? Because I'm not quite hearing. I mean, you just wouldn't have ever been able to do that. You know, you would make a blend, you would automate your blend, and then you would bounce that onto two tracks. And then that was it.
Yeah.
And I mean, you know, when you listen to records that have been done that way, you know, like the Queen records or Mutt Lang's records or, you know, any of those multi-tracks that are floating around, it's a magnificent thing to hear, you know, like, you know, five-part harmony, 30 tracks of Freddie Mercury, like beautifully blended and EQ'd with the reverb burned into the tape, you know, that's...
But that was the norm back then.
That was the norm back then, but that's not the norm now. You can always go back and say, oh, well, you know, that blend is nice, but I still want a little bit more of the top note.
Yeah.
And so you go back. I mean, there are just endless revisions now. And, you know, it's something that, that young up and coming mixers need to be wary of, you know, that there needs to be some kind of bar there. Because, you know, for the amount of money that people are making to mix records these days, which is in many cases a tenth of what people were earning a decade ago, you're spending more time.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, on absolutely. Records. I mean, I think about records that I worked on with like the Fugees or Biggie. You know, I mean, some of those mixes were 3 or 4 hours, one revision. And everybody was feeling it in the room and everyone was nodding their head. And so you printed it. I remember being in the studio with Bob Dylan and, you know, we recorded two songs for two different uses on the same day. And Bob was sitting in the back of the control room with his manager. And, you know, I was just sort of dialing in a rough mix, you know, like literally putting a little bit of reverb on his voice, EQing him a little bit on the Neve desk at Clinton and getting ready to make a cassette for him. And he said, oh, you could go ahead and put that down. And I said, you mean the rough? He said, no, the mix. He said, you don't need to massage it too much. Go ahead and put it down. And this was for The Sopranos, you know? I mean, this was like, this is a big soundtrack.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And I thought, oh my God, you know, like, really? I mean, I've only spent about 15 minutes, you know, just sort of like dialing things in. There's so much more that I could have done with the record. He's like, no, that's all right. You don't need to massage it too much. Just put it down. And That's what I did, you know, and I printed what I had onto a piece of half inch tape. And that was the record. And it was also, you know, the same case for the song that he did for the Hank Williams tribute record, which was, you know, pretty big record at the time, an award winning project. I mean, it just goes to show that, you know, like a lot of these legendary records, you know, Motown records, Stax records, James Brown records, you know, were probably done pretty quickly.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, there was probably a record by the end of the day. I mean, I think it now, like the months, you know,
yeah,
the months and years that you spend like working on a single, it's insane.
Yeah, yeah, right, right.
But that's because you don't ever have to give up. I mean, unless you just run out of money and there's a release demand. I mean, that's the only thing that really stops anyone.
Yeah, it's a different game, that's for sure. One last question for you. A little different. What's the best piece of business advice that you've ever received or learned?
Well, I mean, I've received a lot of really valuable business advice from, you know, producers and mentors that I worked with. I mean, you know, I think one that I've gotten from many people that I've worked with is that, you know, it's all about your relationship with the people that you're working with.
Yeah.
It's not really about the record. It's not really about the song. It's about the people, you know, because I think as Quincy said, you know, you can spend 2 years working on a record and the label won't release it. So you better enjoy your time in the studio.
Well said. Yeah, that's for sure.
You know, I mean, you better enjoy making the record,
yeah.
You know, and I mean, and we all know it's a grueling business and it's really hard. And, you know, you go... on many projects with like lack of sleep for weeks on end and you know, people get burnt out. There's a lot of battle fatigue in the studio. And I think that, you know, so obviously, you know, minding your relationship with the people that you work with is super important. And then, you know, I also think just, you know, figuring out how to take care of yourself, whatever that means. You know, for me, I think it means more and more like leaving the control room and just going on walks, because I think that it's such an obsessive enterprise trying to produce or mix a record. You know, you really get lost in the sauce a lot.
Yeah.
On projects and lose your way. Artists lose their way, mixers lose their way, producers lose their way all the time and lose confidence in what they're doing. And I can think of a lot of circumstances where, you know, I encouraged a producer that I was working with, not because I was trying to grease him, you know, but because I was really just trying to make him feel good about what was already there, mm-hmm. even though, you know, he or she had lost their perspective, had lost their way on the record. And I think it's actually that kind of teamwork and that encouragement that is super important, you know, and I don't know whether there's enough emphasis on that in the educational system. There's such a strong emphasis on all of the technical aspects of the job, but it's so not a technical job.
Yeah. When it's done, yeah.
I mean, we all know this, you know, it's like the magic producer button, which nobody ever talks about. Or the magic producer fader. Hey, well, here, just take this fader. You know, you can ride it, which is, I mean, it's sort of an inside joke. And I've never really like.
Which you can't in the box anymore.
No, you can't. you can't say, oh, here's your fake fader, you know, to ride the vocal yourself.
Yeah.
Because everybody knows what's going on and everybody's much more in tune with what's happening because they're scrutinizing what you're doing at every juncture.
Yeah.
You know, you also can't bullshit as much as you used to be able to. Oh yeah, it's all been taken care of or whatever, you know, because they can just open up your automation and see that it's not been taken care of.
Yeah, right.
I mean, not that I'm trying to bullshit anyone. I'm just saying that, you know, it's there was a lot of sort of like just generally like greasing the producers and greasing the artists historically because they weren't necessarily that in touch with what was happening.
Yeah.
They were just listening to what was coming out of the speakers and, you know, what was actually happening beneath the guts of the mix was the purview of the mixer. And it's not anymore. It's the purview of everyone, you know? So it's more about, I think it's more about acceptance and teamwork than it's ever been.
That's a great place to stop. Thank you so much for your time, Bob. This is terrific. Always a pleasure to talk to you. And
it's a great pleasure to talk to you, Bobby. And I'm looking forward to to huddling together for a cup of coffee next week at AAS.
You got it.
Definitely. All right.
To find out more about Bob Brockman, go to BasieBob.com. That's BasieBob, BasieBob.com. Thanks for listening and being in my inner circle. Remember, if you have any questions or comments, please send them to questions@bobbyoinnercircle.com. I really love to hear your comments. Many thanks to Steve Cherubino, who's the host of the Producer Podcast at theproducer.club, C-L-U-B. And Steve has been helping with this podcast from the beginning. Steve is actually the impetus for the podcast in the first place. He's the one that actually got me thinking about this in the first place. And thank you, Steve, for that. To listen to other episodes of Bobby Osinski's Inner Circle, go to bobbyosinski.com, select the podcast tab, or go to bobbyoinnercircle.com, or you can find it on iTunes or Stitcher. BobbyOsinski.com. You'll also find a sign-up sheet for my newsletter and for alerts for new podcasts. This is Bobby Osinski. I'll see you next time.